This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios.
You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering the life of Philip Kwaku, missionary to Ghana. Really quick, I want to let you guys know that there was a book recommendation on the last for the last episode that we did on the Mongols. Somebody sent in a recommendation for a book called There's a Sheep in My Bathtub about the more modern Mongol missionary efforts there. So if you're interested in that, it's called There's a Sheep in My Bathtub. I also wanted to read two of the most recent Apple reviews that we received because they're really encouraging. The very first one is from S.P. Jackson about Isabel Kuhn and says, I enjoyed hearing about my great aunt, reminiscing about a number of things I knew about her and learning a few more. I have most of her books and love her story. That is really awesome to hear. I'm really excited that the relatives of these people are listening to the show and are enjoying it. So I want to share that with you guys as well because I think it's really cool. And secondly, there was a person named DP919 who sent in this review that I really liked and I wanted to share with you guys. So she says, but says, I'm grateful for this podcast. I spent about 5 years working overseas, working with refugees, and returned to the States a few years ago after feeling a lot of things, ungifted, uncalled, and loss of desire. The Lord has used this podcast to remind me that he calls those to his work, and when he does, he gives them exactly what they need, not more, not less. This podcast has stirred my heart so much for Jesus and the nations knowing his name. He is worthy. That was an amazing review to read for me, and I hope it's encouraging for you guys as well, because through doing this podcast, it's just been really encouraging to me to see all the different just people throughout history that God has used from all walks of life, and I just find that deeply encouraging, and it just shows how amazing our God is, that he can take people that we would look at and be like, I don't know, and then do something wonderful with them. With that being said, let's move into Philip's story. Because this episode will be a little bit different, a little bit in the vein of Felix Carey, if you recall that episode we did a long time ago about William Carey's son. Although it's different because it's not necessarily that Philip himself is a failure per se, but rather that he's put in an impossible situation, which I can't elaborate on at this moment without giving too much away. So just need to bear with me. And before we get into that, we have to talk a little bit about what was going on in Western Africa and kind of the background there so that we can fully appreciate the struggles of his ministry. So Western Africa, including Ghana, was first introduced to the Europeans via the Portuguese, who came in the late 1400s looking for gold. And later on, the Dutch kind of took over, then the Swedes, and then the Danish took portions as well. And then eventually the English came along in the 1600s to get a piece also. The region then quickly changed from focus on the gold trade and then was now almost entirely focused on the slave trade. And it was actually the main hub of the Atlantic slave trade and was dubbed as the Slave Coast, having built at least 41 slave castles or forts. And then in the early 18th century, the Fanti people, which are one of the most predominant people groups along the coast of southern Ghana, formed what was called the Fanti Confederation in order to establish a balance of power against the Europeans. And they operated as a go-between for the Europeans and the Ashanti tribe, which lived in the interior. And the Fanti became quite wealthy and powerful through this arrangement. The very first missionaries to come to Ghana seemed to be the Moravians in about the 1730s. And if you've listened to the episode I did on them about a year and a half ago, this was prime weird sidehole era. But one thing you could say about them is that they were staunchly anti-slavery And the same thing could not be said for Thomas Thompson, who arrived as the first Church of England missionary about 20 years later. Thompson was ordained by the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, or the SPG for short, which I will be calling it from here on out because I'm not saying all that every time. But he had been in New Jersey ministering among settlers when he first encountered enslaved Africans. And then he went and ministered in Ghana and established a school there. And after about 5 years, he needed to return to England for health reasons, and he spent the rest of his life as a vicar. In the year before he died, he wrote a pamphlet defending the slave trade, and the crux of the pamphlet was this. The African trade for Negro slaves is shown to be consistent with principles of humanity and with the laws of revealed religion. Now, Thompson would have seen the slave dungeons where these people were kept, and each of these castles was retrofitted with a dungeon, and the one at Cape Coast could fit up to 1,000 slaves in it. And then Thompson goes on to give this very biblical justification for slavery, biblical being in massive air quotes. But he asked who would possibly cultivate the plantations without them. And he assures the reader that the slave trade is really as vindicable or justifiable as any species of trade whatsoever, because sure, it may look bad, but often they're taken in war, and isn't it more merciful than merely being killed? This was something that was being told in the circles of this time to justify slavery. It will come up a little bit later, so kind of stow that away. But then he goes into the Latin meanings and everything behind slavery and all this stuff, and he's got 31 pages on this. Now, the question is, why would he do this? And the reason is because for 5 years, his employer was the African Company of Merchants, and their primary source of income was the slave trade. And this pamphlet was actually dedicated to the company's committee, so it really seems as simple as that. He was defending his former employer. Now, Thompson was a fellow of Christ College, Cambridge, which gave the pamphlet a great deal of academic clout, and it was widely circulated and caught the attention of Granville Sharp, who is the forefather of Britain's abolitionist movement. And he wrote back a response refuting each of Thompson's points, saying in part, "For shame, Mr. Thompson," which I feel like is like would just grab you like, oh, like, what am I doing with my life? But it didn't do that to Thompson. So during his brief time in Ghana, Thompson was asked to choose suitable boys to send back to England to be educated there and then return for missionary service. And he chose three boys whose names were Thomas Cobbers, William Cudjo, and Philip Kwaku. And Philip was either the son or the grandson of the chief trade agent appointed to the British by the Fanti. And he actually has a whole Wikipedia page on himself, so he was quite well known at the time. And an interesting little cultural tidbit about the Kwaku name is that it was given to all the Fanti boys who were born on a Wednesday. Kind of fun. But in 1754, the three boys were sent off, and Philip would have been about 12 or 13, and I came across an academic journal written by a Ghanaian diplomat to West Germany in the 1950s, and it talked about Philip's life, but I really don't recommend reading it unless you're really into dates and ledgers and all of the very, what I find to be kind of drier stuff. But it was very helpful in outlining where the boys went to school and what they learned. They were sent to live with Mr. Hickman, a schoolmaster in the north of London, and after about 7 weeks, they were brought before the SPG committee to be evaluated. And the account reads, "One of them repeated the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed, and the other two answered well to the questions put to them. The committee was favorably impressed and agreed to recommend to the society that £15 per year each for instruction, boarding, clothing, and other necessities should be paid to Mr. Hickman. The boys learned reading and writing and the catechism, but there's no evidence to suggest whether anything else was taught to them, and the boys stayed with Mr. Hickman until 1759, when they were confirmed and officially baptized into the Church of England. One of the boys, Thomas Cobbers, had died the year before after contracting both the smallpox and then tuberculosis. And then William and Philip were transferred into the care of John Moore, who had previously educated two African boys a few years prior, and one of those boys would actually work as an interpreter for Philip later on, which, if that sounds strange to you, well, just hold on, we'll explain it. But John Moore had recently become the pastor of a small parish church, and he had previously worked as a private schoolmaster and lecturer, hence why he was tasked with the care of these boys. And we can assume that the education was fairly typical of the era, and honestly, we'd already be moving on if it wasn't for the story of the Cock Lane Ghost, an event which captivated the whole of London society, with John Moore right at the center of it. I'm going to read directly from one of the accounts that I found. In January 1762, it was widely reported that a house in London's Cock Lane was haunted by a ghost. The episode began when unexplained noises emanated from the house and a girl, Elizabeth Parsons, was seized by fits. Elizabeth's father, Richard Parsons, the deputy clerk of the St. Sepulchre's, attributed these events to a ghost inhabiting Elizabeth. Parsons consulted with John Moore, the lecturer at his parish, and together they devised a system for communicating with the ghost in which the spirit answered questions with knocks and scratchings. One knock signified yes, two knocks signified no, and scratching indicated that the ghost was upset. And in response to questions posed by Parsons, Moore, and others, the ghost used this system to report that it was the spirit of Frances Lyon, the deceased wife of a former lodger of the Parsons named William Kent. The ghost claimed that William Kent had murdered Frances Lyon with arsenic and that it could not be at peace until Kent was brought to justice. Now, this story of the haunting and explosiveness of the ghost charges obviously caused quite a sensation in London. And William and Philip were notably present for at least one seance. There was more than one, apparently, because there was record of them being among at least 20 other persons, including Moore. This entire event was actually quite damaging to the perception of the growing Methodist movement, which was much more inclined to readily accept the supernatural than their more Anglican traditional counterparts. And Moore himself was considered to have Methodist leanings, Methodist sympathizer kind of guy. A critic wrote about the whole affair: a drunken parish clerk initiated it out of revenge, the Methodists have adopted it, and the whole of London thinks of nothing else. Now, ironically, this critic, 2 years later, would go on to write the very first Gothic novel, a genre known for its supernatural elements. And then, unrelated to this, but maybe not, he also invented the word serendipity. So anyway, the accused man, William Kent, gathered his own team of experts to investigate and prove that he didn't kill his wife. A committee including Moore was formed and decided to have the ghost prove its existence by going down into the burial vault where it would knock on the coffin of the supposedly murdered wife. Naturally, this didn't happen, and Moore confided to another that he was beginning to doubt this entire story at all. Now, Elizabeth Parsons, the girl supposedly inhabited by the ghost, was told to sleep with a maid in a hammock with her hands tied behind her back. Now, once again, the scratchings and knocking ceased. And the girl and her father were told that they would see jail time if the ghost did not make another appearance. So the following night, a witness saw Elizabeth using a board under her bed to make scratching noises and knocking noises. And subsequently, the husband, William Kent, had his wife's tomb opened, proving that she had died of smallpox and not of poisoning. And charges were pressed, including against Moore, and the court went leniently on him, and he was only fined. And even though he was one of the most involved people during these seances, and then he asked what could be considered leading questions of the ghost, he was very apologetic after it all went down. And many concluded that he was just duped and was not malicious in any way. And the SPG chose to keep the boys with Moore and didn't seem to blame him for this incident, even though it did greatly damage his reputation. And it was a bump in the road for the Methodists. But as we all know, they would survive and thrive in later years. Sadly, the other boy, William, who was being educated alongside Philip, suffered a mental breakdown a few years after this event and then died in an asylum about 10 years later. Moore would go on to report to the SPG in 1766 that Philip had rewarded my labors by improving in every branch of knowledge necessary to the station for which he was designed. And Philip likewise considered Moore a good and trustworthy tutor, and in fact, he continued his relationship with the Moore family even after returning to Ghana. He entrusted Moore's son, who was about his age, with handling his finances and arranging for the educational needs of his children, who he would later send back to England. Now, often in Philip's biography, you will see him recognized as the first African to be educated at Oxford. And this doesn't seem to be historically accurate. There are no SPG records suggesting or stating that he was educated at Oxford. Philip doesn't make mention of it either, as far as I could find. Also, it's unlikely that the SPG would have sprung for the tuition that Oxford would have meant, considering how paltry a sum they were handing out for his other needs. Philip is, however, the very first African to be ordained as a priest by the Church of England. So he was ordained and then married in 1765, and he married an English woman named Catherine Blunt. And there are only two things we know about her, which is that she was literate because on her marriage certificate, she signed her name as opposed to the other exes that were put down as witnesses and such. But then she also died of disease not long after arriving in Ghana.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Now, we can't necessarily see how Philip's worldview changed from his time in England because we have nothing to compare it to, but we can see that he became very English. He was also Anglican through and through. He didn't much care for the Quakers or the Presbyterians. In fact, he complained that the governor of Cape Coast was a very rank Presbyterian born and bred. He also disliked Roman Catholicism. Attending a service on his way to Ghana, he wrote that, instead of true devotion, the worship of God is here turned by these pretended saints into idolatry and the utmost ridicule. And if he had any hope at all of being welcomed back into the fold of his family after returning, he never got it. In fact, they were a constant thorn in his side. And it sounds like there was an idea among his family that he would have come back a rich man and that he owed them. And so the relationship remained strained throughout his entire life. And I don't know if you can hear these epic booms of thunder. I kind of hope they pick up on the recording, but maybe they won't. But not to excuse his family, but he might not have been entirely blameless in this relationship because in the 11 years that he had been away, he had lost the ability to speak his native tongue. This was during a period of time when the English language was considered to be the language of the civilized. And so they considered one's language to be the chief cause of a barbarous culture and incivility. The SPG, however, did not share this sentiment and considered the recovery of Philip's native tongue to be of the utmost importance to the success of his mission. Makes sense. But there is no evidence to suggest that he even ever tried. He lived in the Cape Coast castle and used interpreters for the rest of his life. Now, whether he forgot his native tongue or just refused to use it, we don't know. But there is further evidence for the disdain that he held for the language. Because in one of his letters where he was sending his children back to school, he stated that this sending them away was the only way to secure their tender minds from receiving bad habits and also to guarantee that they would lose their mother's vile jargon, the only obstacles of learning in these parts. Now, after the death of Catherine, he would go on to marry two more times, and we don't know their names or really anything about them except for the fact that one of these women was a former slave of his that he then married, which was apparently not an uncommon practice in the region. So it appears that from the day he first set foot back in Ghana to the day that he died, he pretty much exclusively lived in the Cape Coast Castle. He had a couple of rooms set aside there, and this castle served as the administrative hub for the African Company of Merchants, and he was officially both the chaplain and the school teacher for this company, and his salary was split equally between both them and the SPG. And he was tasked with starting a school for the biracial children, both boys and girls, who lived in the castle. And then later on, he took in some children from outside the castle who were considered to be day scholars of the African upper middle class. Enrollment was never high, though, and this may be one of the first times we've covered the story of someone who ran a school and the problem was too little enrollment because usually they were overflowing. But Philip's number never exceeded 16 students, and at times it dwindled down to zero. And one of the biggest problems that Philip faced was lack of interest because families considered informal schooling soldiering, mending, or accounting to be more useful. And Philip's school did teach accounting, but he was more focused on English language learning and religious instruction, namely the Catechism and the Common Book of Prayer. He did report the students he did have were performing extremely well, but often this wasn't enough to keep them in school for the whole time. And another reason he struggled was lack of support from the SPG and England at large. When he came back to Ghana, the Seven Years' War or the French and Indian War had just wrapped up. The American colonies were unstable, and that eventually led to the War for Independence, which then in turn destabilized the West Indies trade system. And then the French Revolution came, and that was followed by the Napoleonic Wars. And then on the Ghana home front, there was civil unrest brewing for 25 years, which eventually culminated in the invasion of the coast by the Ashanti in 1807. And then, in addition to this, a disease was a constant problem, especially malaria and yellow fever. So because of these reasons, the risk of disease, civil unrest, and then world affairs, Ghana was not a posting given to the most genteel of the British military or British society at large that might have aided Philip's efforts. And then also, because of all this, his profession as a chaplain was not highly regarded. Sunday service was mandatory, but certain exceptions could be made if need be, and these were called blank Sundays. In the year 1777, 13 such blank Sundays were submitted for reasons that included a custom of the townspeople, the governor being out of town, an officer unable to attend, the presence of a stranger, and the weather. So during some years, services were suspended for almost a year. Many of the governors were supportive, and then one openly ridiculed the idea of religion, but one governor came to Philip's defense when a man refused to hear him preach due to the color of his skin. The man said that he basically had no interest in anything a black man had to say, and the governor responded that none but the most illiterate could make any objection based on the color of a man's skin. Now, for his part, Philip wrote back constant updates to England on how things were progressing for him. And some of them were actually quite anguished, and in his 50 years of ministry, he only received 3 letters from the SPG in return. They honestly left him stranded without any emotional or physical support, and he was the only man working all that time. And it even appears that they forgot to pay him for like 3 years. And this leads us to an interesting quandary, because due to his dual employment, both by the SPG and the African Company of Merchants, he often took postings in various castles working as a merchant, and this would include working in that side of the slave trade. And the SPG seemed to think that he dabbled too much in the market at one point, and so they reprimanded him pretty sharply. But on the other hand, the SPG was not opposed to the slave trade because they actually turned down an offer by a Quaker to partner together to help end it. And then they were also partnered to a company which literally made the slave trade their bread and butter. Now, interestingly, Philip never makes much of his views on slavery one way or the other until later in his life, and even then you really wouldn't call him an abolitionist. But he did come to the conclusion that one of the main reasons for the failures of his mission was the slave trade. And due to his unique status as an English-educated African ministering to his own people, he was of great interest to the growing anti-slavery movement that was happening abroad. And Samuel Hopkins, an American minister and leading figure of the early abolitionist movement, exchanged letters with Philip in 1773. And the following year, Phyllis Wheatley, who was newly emancipated and also a newly published author, was communicating with Samuel Hopkins, expressing sadness that Philip was not more successful in his mission, while also suggesting that he could be more successful if he set a fine example. And this letter actually still exists today, and you can look at it on the Internet Archive if you're interested. And then in 1769, Philip wrote to Samuel Johnson, who was a fellow SPG missionary, that the stir of religion and its everlasting recompense is not so much in vogue as the vicious practice of purchasing flesh and blood like oxen in marketplaces. And he argued that African nations are kept in ignorance for interest and profit's sake, while Christian humanity and fellow feeling is blinded with profit and loss. And Philip agreed with Johnson's sentiment that the cursed slave trade is the only obstruction to ministering in these desolate parts. And he also lamented the fact that necessity has driven many promising youths to get their fortune by such way of traffic. Now, despite what he wrote in his correspondences, he continued to still work in the administrative side of the slave trade, and his own living quarters were above the slave dungeon. To me, his story has some parallels with the life of Lot in this way. However, there is some evidence to suggest that by the 1790s, he was becoming more vocally outspoken against the slave trade. Anti-slavery proponents testified to the House of Commons using Philip's firsthand accounts. A surgeon who had visited the Gold Coast a couple of years before testified that Philip told him that the greatest number of slaves were made by kidnapping. This report was in direct opposition to the arguments made by Thomas Thompson and others that these enslaved people were captives just fortunate enough to have their lives spared. Another man, an officer in the Royal Navy, stated that Philip told him that the wars in the interior existed for the sole purpose of procuring people for the slave trade. And then a year or so after these testimonies were given, Philip was ordered by the governor to accompany him on a military campaign against a town which had risen up against the English fort. He refused because he rightly felt that his participation would be highly inconsistent and injurious to his profession and station. So as a result, this governor punished him by dismissing him from service and kicking him out of the castle. So he spent 11 months without official employment, but then he was reinstated and qualifiers were given that he only needed to perform religious duties and no longer needed to participate in the trade or administrative functions of the company. And although Philip would go on to live and minister for another 25 years, this is the end of the information that I could find. The only other information would be that he died in 1816 at the age of 75. There is, however, one account which I will read here, even though I do believe that it is blatantly false, considering both the source and the fact that it is riddled with inaccuracies, which I believe you will pick up on as well. And this account comes from the story, from the book Stories of Strange Lands, which was published by a naturalist couple in 1835. And the pages surrounding this account show that they had little regard for Africans while also couching their disdain in this pitying language that honestly is really gross. But their brief account reads this way. In consequence of the rapid mortality which took place at Cape Coast and was in after years diminished by more temperate habits and skillful medical officers, it was suggested that a colored man should be educated in England for the chaplaincy. Accordingly, one man named Kwaku, aged 19, was taken from among the canoe men. In the first place, it was injudicious to choose him from the worst set of men in the community. And the next, he was too old, but he was sent to England, christened, educated at Westminster, and then in a few years ordained by the then Bishop of London. He returned to Cape Coast as the Reverend Philip Kwaku, and for some years performed the church service in his rooms at the castle. He married a black woman, himself performing the Christian rites. His life was tolerably moral, and he was supposed to have no fear of death, and even to desire it. He sent to England for a tombstone properly inscribed with his name and profession. But the hour arrived which proved us all, and he sent for the old fetish women of Cape Coast, who smeared his doorpost with blood and eggs, practiced every charm ever invented by African pagans, and he died in the midst of their yells and incantations, his greatest consolation being that, according to his request, he should be buried in the spur of the fortress, and everyone would see that he had been Parson Kwaku. Now, there is absolutely zero evidence for this outside of this one source, which comes from people passing through about 20 years after he had died, and it also doesn't match up with anything else we know about him. He sent his own children away to England. He refused to relearn his own native language. And there was a certain animosity between him and his extended relations. And he spent most of his life in European circles and in correspondence with both Europeans and Americans abroad. And he took great pains to educate the children in his care, however few they may have been, in the tenets of the Christian faith. And there are many faults that we can find in the life of Philip, but last-minute apostate does not seem to be one of them. And I likened to Philip to Lot a little bit earlier, and I think that's honestly the best way to describe him, because he was all alone, working and attempting to minister in a hostile environment. He was rarely respected by Europeans, and he was a strange anomaly to the Africans. And then he alienated those he was chosen to minister to and was often rejected by the Europeans with whom he identified more. He was a Christian minister and also a slave owner, having owned at least 5 slaves. He was against the slave trade while also benefiting from it, and this does seem to have changed as he matured and as the anti-slavery sentiments became more popular, but we have no evidence of how he spent the remaining half of his ministry. He asked for help to be sent to him, and it never was. He also asked for funds to build a schoolhouse, and that was denied. In the first few years of his ministry, he's mentioned in the SPG annual reports But after about a decade without results, his name and ministry no longer appeared. And I don't want to leave you in this state of depression, so I'll tell you that there is some good news. Because England abolished the slave trade in 1807, and the African Company of Merchants was dissolved in 1821 after it failed to suppress the slave trade. And then Ghana became an official British colony in the same year, and its new governor implemented an educational program. And some of the teachers for that new school and program had been students of Phillips. And then in 1834, two formal pupils of his invited the Wesleyan Missionary Society, the missionary branch of the Methodist movement, into the country. And these later missionaries enjoyed the support of their mission and saw many ministry successes. And I do think it is important to note that their ministry successes came after the abolition of the slave trade, which is one of the things that Philip and others blamed for their lack of success among the people. So in the end, they were proven right. I think there are a few things we can take away from Philip's story. Number one, and very obviously, is that a Christian cannot work in harmony with an evil institution. And number two, it is important for missionaries to have the support of their mission behind them. How much more invigorated would Philip have been if he had received more than three letters in his 50 years of ministry? And as far as we know, they never even sent anybody to check up on him, and they only cared when they thought he was giving too much time to the African Company of Merchants. And not even about him, but really about critiquing him. And number three, Christians should not live and work in isolation. Iron sharpens iron. Would Philip have held some of the prejudices and viewpoints that he did if he had been in a Christian community that he could have talked things through with? As it says in Ecclesiastes, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. As always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.